Welcome.
Bienvenido.
Tusanyo sokolaba.
Magandang araw sa inyo.
Swagatam.
Bande ko babolingo. Bozali koyoka here on earth.
Here on earth.
환영합니다.
Here on earth.
Welcome to Here on Earth.
Apple of my eye, you're luscious and you're sweet. You're the apple of my eye, you're sweet enough to eat.
Mm.
Now since we met, I always get that certain feeling. And furthermore, I love you, for you're so appealing. You're the apple of my
eye. It took thousands of years to create the luscious, sweet apples we know today. And sadly, the gene pool for apples has dwindled drastically. The United States was once home to more than 10,000 different varieties. Now it's hard to find more than a handful, even at farmers' markets. We're about to meet a man who's been working hard to reverse that trend. But instead of trekking across North America planting seedlings like Johnny Appleseed, he went in the other direction, east to Central Asia. The motherlode of all apples, the ancestral home of Red Delicious, Golden Delicious, and Macintosh, lies not in New England, but in Kazakhstan. I'm Jean Faraca. Welcome to the Friday edition of Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders from Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, the big family of apples. Thomas Jefferson's idea of the perfect apple was spicy and hard. What's yours? Are there any famous apple trees in your neighborhood? When you bite into that first apple of the season, what memories does it bring back? To join the conversation, call 1-800-642-1234. Again, that's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is hereonearth@wpr.org. You can also send an instant message on AOL or MSN to Here on Earth using our screen name, Here on Earth Radio. Philip Forsline is the 21st century Johnny Appleseed. He's a horticulturalist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the curator of the department's apple collection since 1984. He has tasted every one of the 2,500 varieties of apples in that collection. Philip Forsline, welcome to Here on Earth.
Glad to be here, Jean. You can just call me Phil, and my last name is pronounced Forslin.
Forslin, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's actually a Swedish name. I grew up in northern Minnesota, the upper Midwest, where you're from. My father was an immigrant from Sweden. So here I am in the beautiful area of upstate New York, the Finger Lakes region, where we have a lot of agriculture. A lot of people in the Midwest do not know that New York State is a very agricultural state.
Oh, well, I know it. I came from New York. You can't escape that if you, you know, learn geography in the sixth grade. I want to know a little bit more about the farm you grew up on in Minneapolis, in Minnesota.
as you know, Minnesota is a very agricultural state. It has some of the best soil in the country. But it seemed as though a lot of the Scandinavians, the Norwegians, and the Swedes bypassed that really good soil down in southern Minnesota where the Dutch and German tended to be, and they went up to the North Woods where life was a little bit tougher. So that's where my father settled, north of the Iron Range in northern Minnesota in a little town called Cook, Minnesota. And there my mother and father raised 10 children. I'm the youngest of 10. I loved agriculture, had to milk cows, but where I got interested in horticulture was following my mother around with the family vegetable garden.
Mm-hmm.
So I went from essentially pomme de terre, potatoes, to pomme, which is apples, here in my career.
And how was it that you got so interested in apples?
Well, I went to the University of Minnesota, majoring in horticulture, had a little hiatus when I was in the military for a couple of years, and then came to graduate school at the University of Maine, A job opened up at the New York State Agricultural Experiment Station, which is part of the Cornell University. It's about 50 miles north of the main campus of Cornell in Ithaca. And I received my first job there, working with a project leader who was breeding apple rootstocks. So I learned all about pomology, or apples, essentially on the job. I knew a little bit about apples from Minnesota, and that up in northern Minnesota, where it gets to be 50 below zero at times, about the only apple that survived up there was a little crab apple called Dolgel crab, which my mother used to make crab apple jelly out of. But I essentially learned all that I really know about apples when I started my job in 1973 here at the Geneva Experiment Station. Mm. And then I became curator, a USDA project in 1984, about 11 years after I arrived here at Cornell, but stayed in the same area.
And you've made 7 expeditions to Central Asia in search of this Eden of apples that apparently lies particularly in Kazakhstan.
Well, let me clarify that a little bit. Now, it's always been a team working. It's not just me. In 1989, this was 5 years after I became the curator for the apple collection here at Geneva, the U.S. Department of Agriculture. I had assembled a very large collection, maybe 2,000 different varieties, some heirloom types and other popular cultivars or varieties. But as a committee, we got together and realized that we needed to get more genetic diversity. So 3 of my colleagues took that first trip to Kazakhstan in 1989 while I was busily getting my collection together. I'll give a lot of credit to Dr. Herb Aldwinkel, a Cornell professor, plant pathology department here at Geneva, who took that first trip with Dr. Calvin Sperling and a graduate student at that time, Elizabeth Dixon. They came back all excited about what they had seen and essentially turned me on to making collections there. So we invited, I think you've probably read in the literature, Professor John Galeev, who actually met Nikolai Vavilov. I caught in your introduction that you mentioned Nikolai Vavilov from 1929. But this fellow now, he's still living. He's 97 years old. When we first had him come to Geneva in 1992.
We have to back up a little bit.
Yeah.
It was this Russian botanist, Nikolai Vavilov.
Yes.
Who actually originally identified what you call the mother lode of apples.
Exactly.
in Central
yes.
Asia, in Kazakhstan. Am I right about
yes.
that?
And, yes.
And then it was his, I mean, it's a very interesting Russian history here. We don't want to get lost in it, but I think it's worth it's worth recounting. I mean, he falls victim to Stalin.
Yes.
And ends up dying in one of Stalin's prisons. And if it hadn't been for his last surviving student, we would have lost this knowledge.
I think that's exactly right. This Professor John Galeev took care of Vavilov's horse, is the way I understand it, as a young student, and essentially became a disciple of Vavilov. Stalin put all of his guidance in a fellow named Lysenko. Have you heard that name?
No.
Lysenko was a bogus scientist. It actually has developed a term called Lysenkoism. And he did not believe that Vavilov was on the right track, so Vavilov lost his life in prison. But fortunately, Professor John Galeev.
Yeah, I think I remember hearing that Stalin was against genetics.
Yes, exactly. He did not understand why Vavilov had to go all around the world collecting all this germplasm, as we call it, or plant genetic resources. That's essentially what we're tasked to do in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We have an organization called the National Plant Germplasm System. So he was well ahead of anybody else in the world in going around to these centers of origin and collecting all kinds of agricultural crops. In fact, the institute up in St. Petersburg now is called the Vavilov Institute, where they have large stores of genetic resources. Because of the government of the former Soviet Union, there has not been a lot done with that. But there's a lot of efforts to get the Vavilov Institute up to where it ought to be. But it was named after Nikolai Vavilov. Uh-huh. So I know I'm kind of backing up in terms of what you had originally asked me, but I'll have you ask the next question here in terms of where we want to go with this.
Well, when you finally found these forests that Vavilov described, what was it like? What did they look like?
Yeah, well, let me go back to 1992, where we actually invited Professor John Galeev and an interpreter and one of his other scientists to Cornell University, to the U.S. Department of Agriculture program here, to visit with us to lay out a plan for going back and collecting more after Dr. Aldwinkle and Dr. Sperling and Elizabeth Dixon had been there in 89. So we laid out the plan with maps. We were going to go to lots of different areas within this range where apples grow. And we made that second trip in the fall of 1993. And I had a team of three individuals from the United States, the same graduate student, Elizabeth Dixon from Cornell, a plant pathologist from Washington State University, Gaylord Mink, joined us, and then a scientist from New Zealand caught up with us when we arrived in Alma-Ata. Alma-Ata at that time was the capital city of Kazakhstan. It has now been moved up more to central Kazakhstan to a town called Astana. But Alma-Ata actually means the father of the apple. Mm-hmm. So they knew what they had there. It's a very large city, a bustling city now. I have not been back there since 96. So we entered that area. We were welcomed by Dr. John Galeev, or Professor John Galeev, on a September evening as we arrived.
And I understand you noticed that there were apple trees growing right up through the cracks in the sidewalk.
Well, I think that was Frank Browning's discussion in the book Apples. I'm not sure I could really say that. We actually had to, first morning when we arrived, we got in a helicopter and flew up to an area about, I would say maybe 300 miles or so north to the Jungarski Mountains and landed. And that's where we became aware of these gigantic forests. Some of the trees were maybe 5 or 6 feet in diameter, 60 feet tall, and forests of apples that were at levels of, well, I'll use the metric system here, from about 1,100 meters in elevation all the way up to about, 1,800 meters in elevation. So we climbed these hills and saw all these different forests in that particular area. But unfortunately, that particular year, 1993, they had had a very severe frost in the forest, so we did not see many apples on the trees.
Oh.
But it turned out when we were making these collections, wherever we could see apples, we collected them. This was in some ways a fortunate type of deal, because maybe we were already selecting for some tolerance to frost avoidance. So we've actually been doing some research on that with those materials that were collected at that time, and I've got a project going with some researchers at Ohio State University looking at that very aspect. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting then to see, as we went through the forest, wherever there were apples on the trees, we would see branches that were broken. Bears had been up there feasting on the apples. Wherever there were apples, they would go after them.
And it turns out bears are a very important part of this story. If it weren't bears, the apples would not have gotten disseminated.
Yeah, it's we give credit to the bears, but there are other forest dwellers that fed on the apples. We're sure of that, other mammals. But I've got photographs that I use when I make my presentations that shows bear scat with apple seeds in the bear scat. And the bears really are the ones that would eat the apples. The apples, or the apple seeds, would go right through the bear, through the whole system, and be planted as seeds that then would germinate and create the trees in the forest.
Mm. We're talking this hour with Philip Forslund. He is a horticulturalist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the curator of the department's apple collection. He's tasted every one of those 2,500 varieties of apples in the collection, and he is working to improve the germ stock of apples in the United States. We'll find out more about that right after this break. I'm Jean Faraca. You're listening to Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. We're at 1-800-642-1234. What's your favorite apple?
da 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 da
I'm Jean Faraca. You're listening to Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders, where Fridays we talk about food. Today, we are talking about apples, the big family of apples, with Philip Forslund, a horticulturalist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture who's made 7 expeditions to Central Asia in search of the Eden, the Garden of Eden of apples in Alma-Ata, Kazakhstan. We're at 1-800-642-1234. I mentioned earlier that Thomas Jefferson's favorite apple was spicy and hard. So many varieties. What's your favorite? Philip Forslund, or Phil, thank you for letting me call you Phil.
Okay.
Thomas Jefferson was also something of a geneticist, wasn't he? He was experimenting.
Yes, that's what we've all read, and we actually have in our collection some of these heirloom-type varieties that a lot of the population is interested in. You know, the heirloom types are really popular with the culture now, and I get a lot of questions as a curator, where can I find some of these heirloom varieties? But one of his favorite one was one called Aesopus Spitzenberg. And we have that in our collection. So when I give tours, I usually point that out, that this is Thomas Jefferson's favorite apple as we understand it.
Uh-huh.
It's actually not a very bad apple. It's I think it's been used to breed additional apples. But it's just one of the 2,500 what I call clones or cultivars in our collection. You mentioned that I've tasted all of these. Yes, indeed, I have. Many of them are very bad tasting. They're very astringent. They dry your mouth out. But not only did I taste all those, when we collected the apples in Kazakhstan and other parts of Central Asia and China and Turkey and Russia where I've been, I've tasted all those. And for the most part, real quality in apples is a rarity. I've tasted the apples from the 1,000 different trees that we collected apples from in the forests of Kazakhstan, plus the apples that we've collected in Turkey and Russia and China. So it's been a great experience to taste a lot of these apples, but for the most part, it's not a pleasant test for
a lot
for
of them
most
are,
of the apples.
Were spitters, huh?
Yes, they were.
We got a message from Matt in Managua who called and wanted to know what apples are native to Wisconsin. He also mentioned that he's an amateur archaeologist, and when he's looking for traces of civilization, the first thing he looks for is apple trees. Why is that, do you think?
Well, you know, just to get back, there's been a lot of books and articles written about the origin of the apple. And, you know, you're right, the apple essentially came from Kazakhstan. But as the old world settlers or the east-west trade routes were opening up from, say, China to the Middle East, these people traveled right through that area of Kazakhstan and found the apples and obviously carried them with them. So
that was along the Silk Road, wasn't it?
Yeah, that then became the Silk Road. So then, you know, shortly after that, or about 3,000 to 4,000 years ago, there's record that individuals learned how to graft apples and select the best apple. In order to retain an apple of the quality that you wanted, you can't plant the seed because it's so heterozygous. You must graft it. So we've been cloning apple trees for 3,000 to 4,000 years through the grafting process.
Uh-huh.
So as these individuals in the Middle East learned the grafting process, the apple moved its way up into Europe, and Europeans became even better selectors of the apple. Well, this is a long story. Then when the old world settlers came to North America, of course, you know, we all know the Johnny Appleseed story as a child growing up. It was my favorite book. I really wore that thing out. But here I am in my career. Some people refer to me as the modern day Johnny Appleseed. So what happened in North America is that when the settlers came here, they didn't have the skill or the time to graft apples, but they planted millions and millions of apple trees east of the Mississippi River. So out of that gene pool, North America became a kind of a secondary center of origin for apple, because it was this gene pool that came over in barrels of apples on ships, but the seeds were planted. So every one of those trees in eastern North America was a unique genetic entity. So out of that came the Red Delicious variety that was found in Iowa on Jesse Hyatt's farm. So every Red Delicious that you ever has made it in the marketplace can be traced back to that original tree. It wasn't bred by anybody. It was selected as a chance seedling. Okay. The same thing can be said about Golden Delicious found in West Virginia, McIntosh in Ontario, Canada. But getting to the question of Matt in Wisconsin, what's native to Wisconsin? Well, I'm sure a number of these chance seedlings were found there. In fact, one of the largest apples we have in our collection, and I believe his name was Matt, probably knows this one. It's one called Wolf River. It's out of Wisconsin. Have you heard of that one?
Yeah.
Yeah. So outside of that, I can't really tell you. There's probably all kinds of what I would call, they're not, a lot of people refer to them as wild apples. If you go through some of these hedgerows on people's farms, you'll see apples that are growing there. Essentially, what they are just escapes of the commercial apple or the, I would call it the Johnny Appleseed gene pool. Some people will look at it and say, what variety is this? Well, for the most part, it is not a named variety, perhaps, but just a chance seedling. So not as many of those chance seedlings are around now as they were, say, 200 to 100 years ago.
It's interesting that apples really need people to bring them into their fullness. I mean, I was hiking last weekend around Indian Lake here in Dane County, and there were lots and lots of apple trees there, but very gnarly, worm-eaten. You know, you could bite into them and maybe get a little bit of flavor, but nothing that you'd really want to savor. And it occurred to me that the story of apples is really the story of nature and culture.
Yes, and Michael Pollan, of course, mentioned that in his book, The Botany of Desire, which I'm sure a lot of people have read. In fact, that's kind of an interesting story for us because in that book he says that Phil Forslund will send seeds to anybody who asks of these collections that I made in Kazakhstan. Well, of the 130,000 seeds that we brought back, those are very valuable seeds that I need to send to my collaborative researchers so they can send data back to me. But I've gotten maybe 800 emails from people that have read that book. So what we've done, we've got now, I call it Kazakhstan recreated right here in Geneva, New York. There are 11, 12-year-old trees that are fruiting very heavily. So I like to get away from the computer this time of year and go out there and evaluate those trees. I feel like I'm right back in Kazakhstan, except the rows are nice and neat and well cared for, so it's not random like in the forest. But what we do, we actually collect open-pollinated seeds from this Kazakh grow-out, and then we've sent out about 100 seeds to about 300 of these individuals who have asked for some seeds. So we don't turn them down. So now we've got a number of Johnny Appleseed wannabes all around the country, not only in the country, but Canada, and we've got seeds that we've sent to individuals in Europe that have read that book.
And just briefly, tell us what the significance of this hybridization, maybe that's not the right word, but as I understand it, we're down to a very small gene pool in terms of our apple stock. And what your expeditions have accomplished is at least doubling what's available. How would you explain the significance of what you've done?
Well, I think I would go beyond double because what we have, the North American gene pool is a very good gene pool because these varieties like Red Delicious, Golden Delicious, McIntosh, Jonathan have been used to create by breeders some really significant apples that are important in the marketplace right now. Like upstate New York has a very favorite one called Empire. That's a cross between Red Delicious and Golden Delicious. So that gene pool is very important. Jonna Gold is another one that a lot of people like, cross between Jonathan and Golden Delicious. My favorite apple right now is, maybe it's a little biased to my home state of Minnesota, but it's one that you probably know out in Wisconsin, Honeycrisp apple.
Oh, yeah.
It's just excellent in terms of its texture. So what I'm getting at here is that this gene pool, as important as it is, probably was selected mainly for quality. Like I said, quality is a rare trait within the gene pool of apple. So what we've done, we've gone back to the center of origin where apples have evolved in the introduction. I heard you say for thousands of years. Well, maybe millions of years. I was reading an article in the Orion magazine written by Gary Nabhan. I don't know if you've seen that article. It's called The Fatherland of Apples. He describes that at about 4.5 million years. I've worked quite a bit with a researcher from Oxford University, Dr. Barry Juniper, who's just recently written a book called The Story of the Apple. Very interesting. It's in Timber Press, just recently came out. But he says the origin of the apples go back maybe 7 to 8 million years ago, and that birds disseminated apples into Central Asia. And this then became an isolated area where the bears and other forest dwellers naturally selected for quality. So what we've found in these apples that we've collected in Kazakhstan and Central Asia is not only traits for quality, which we find are very rare among some things, but when we walk through the forests of Kazakhstan, we find apples that at their smallest are about an inch in diameter. And at their largest, they look like anything that would come right off the supermarket shelf. So it's quite amazing. And what we found, not only the quality aspects, but with the collaborative research that I've been doing with researchers around the world and here at Cornell University and other state universities, Michigan State University, Iowa and Washington and Ohio, We're finding that there's high levels of disease resistance, particularly apple scab. Apple scab is a
disease. That's really the most significant thing that your expeditions have achieved is strengthening resistance to disease.
Yes. Scab, the reason we're finding resistance there is that apple scab is endemic to the area of Kazakhstan, as are the apples. So there's been kind of an coevolution. So the apples, under natural selection and pressure from the apple scab, develop these resistances. So we're finding very high levels of resistance that now we can recommend at some point after a lot of evaluation and research. So a new gene pool for breeders to use to improve the apple, not only for possible more additional horticultural quality, but for disease resistance. Also, the areas where we collected, they range from 37 degrees latitude all the way up to 47.5, similar to my area where I grew up in northern Minnesota. So adaptation to different climates, cold climates, maybe dry climates, resistance to drought, because we found some of these apples in very xeric or desert-like areas.
We have callers that want to join the conversation. I want to bring them in. Charlie's been waiting in Wausau. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
The question I had is, the thing with apples for me is, if I bite into an apple for the first time, I want like half the apple to come off with the bite. If my teeth like sink in and it just kind of mushes in, I'll just throw the apple aside, because for me texture is definitely the most important. And so my question is, what and another thing with that is, I'll like have one type apple, like Golden Delicious, and it'll be like that, but then I'll buy that brand again and it won't. And so is there a type of apple that is the most crunchy, like the most consistently crunchy, or like what makes an apple crunchy? And also, what's a variety that I could grow in Wisconsin?
Okay,
you
probably heard my discussion earlier. You sound like me talking there. For me, an apple, flavor is important, but for me, the main thing is texture. If I have texture, flavor is secondary. But if I can get both, and that's what I'm hoping the breeders can eventually come up with, is an apple that has the best flavor and the best texture. For me, an apple that has the best texture right now is this Honeycrisp apple. And I have to admit, one that comes out of Japan, although it's a little sweeter than I like it, Fuji is not a bad apple in terms of having a pretty good texture.
No, that's derived from the same stock, isn't it?
It's using some of these North American type apples that the breeders have had this narrow gene pool to work with, but now we've got this broader gene pool where we've gone back to this center of origin where the apple has had a chance to evolve for millions of years, so that we now can get around you know, not just selecting apples for quality, but for other traits, because we have all of these. And we're actually working with researchers to using the modern tools of genomics to map the genes, just like in the human genome that's been sequenced. Now they're just about ready to release the sequence for apple. So, you know, I'm not a molecular geneticist, more of a horticulturist or botanist. I know the real plant, but we've got a lot of skilled researchers that are doing some of this work in genetics right now. So, in answer to your question, in terms of biting at an apple and soft, you never know. You go to a supermarket and buy an apple. Sometimes it might taste good, but a lot of apples have a short shelf life. If they sit out at room temperature for a while, they will get that mushy, soft taste. You know, a red delicious apple, if it's grown right and picked at the right time, can be a pretty good apple. But for the most part, we've all had the experience going to a supermarket and getting a red delicious apple, and you bite into it and it's mushy, or you bite into it and the flesh is almost green. It's not even ripe.
Well, we've been fascinated by the lists of flavor notes that come from all of these varieties of apples. Many of them taste like roses. Some of them have a hint of anise or pineapple. How did we lose all that nuance and when it comes down to a red delicious apple?
Well, first I have to ask, as I looked at the program here, is my colleague Dr. Randy Beaudry on the...
I'm sorry, he wasn't able to connect.
Oh, well, as I've indicated before, I don't do this research alone. This is as a team, not only the collecting of the apple, but getting out and doing the evaluation and characterization. That's essentially why I have not been back to Kazakhstan since 1996. We're really promoting characterization so that we can promote the utilization of this great gene pool that we have. So I'm taking... a lot of pride in the ability to do that with my colleague researchers. And one of them is Dr. Randy Beaudry from Michigan State, who concentrates on these flavors. So he came and we walked through the orchard. And a lot of you read the article in the New York Times by Hal McGee that came out in Thanksgiving last year. That's where these descriptions were given by Dr. Randy Beaudry. It's walking through the orchard, and you feel like you're with a wine connoisseur who can pick out all these tastes.
Mm.
So he's the one that described these. But I agree with him. Some of them have almost an anise or licorice flavor. There's one that when I bring a tour group out, I had a number of tours last Saturday, college classes that came through. I give them a little test. There's a crabapple variety we call Kerr. We got it from Canada. And I asked them to taste this, and it's just got a flavor. If they could put that flavor in an apple with texture, for me, it would be my favorite apple.
Mm-hmm.
But they bite into it, and some of them say, oh, it tastes like wine. Well, I said, you're close. Dr. Beaudry describes this as a
Gewürztraminer.
Yeah, tropical fruit lychee. But I always said, hey, this tastes like Gewürztraminer wine. If you've ever been in the Finger Lakes region of New York, that's one of the popular wines here. It's kind of a spicy taste.
A winey, winey apple. All kinds of flavors and aromas, too. Flowers and spices and nuts, even coconut. Have you ever tasted an apple that tastes of coconut or reminds you?
Oh, yes.
Other apples, rhubarb, green banana, strawberry, orange peel, and so on and so forth. We are gathering in the big family of apples this hour with Philip Forslund, horticulturalist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. I'm Jean Faraca. You're listening to Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. We're at 1-800-642-1234. Let's talk a little bit about what you can do with apples. There's a wonderful recipe for apple soup in that New York Times article that I'd like to talk about, but you may have other fascinating ways of enjoying apples. And somebody wants to know, how is it that apple pie became synonymous with America? 1-800-642-1234. Did you grow up with an apple tree in your backyard? Were the apples any good? Turns out that apples require more pesticides than any other food. They are sprayed as many as, I think, 12 times in a season. That's a bit shocking. We're talking apples this hour and the Big Apple family with Phil Forslund, horticulturalist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We're at 1-800-642-1234. What's your favorite apple, and what are your apple memories? What place do apples have in the mythology of the United States? 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is hereonearth@wpr.org. And Philip, oops, we just lost him. Well, we have Phil Forslund with us. Did you grow up with an apple tree in your backyard, Phil?
Well, as I indicated, you know, I didn't know apples a whole lot growing up in the cold weather of northern Minnesota. They didn't survive very well. But my neighbor had a Dulgo crab, which has apples only about less than an inch in diameter. But they have a really nice flavor. They're quite tart. My mother used to make crab apple jelly with them. But I remember as a child being fascinated with this Dulgo crab. I would get up on a ladder and pick the fruit and proudly bring them home, and my mother would juice them up and make this crabapple jelly. And then I had another neighbor who actually had some fairly large cold hardy apples that I was fascinated when we would drive into the yard and see these apples growing on the tree, but never really knew what kind they ever were. So I knew that apples did survive up in those cold areas. But my experience was no apples in our yard, but a neighbor who lived about a half a mile away had this apple tree that he allowed us to harvest the apples from.
We have Janet joining us from Wausau. Hi, Janet. Thanks for your call.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Yes. Years ago, about late 50s, early... Are you still there?
Yes.
Okay. My husband had tasted a golden russet, and we've checked northern Wisconsin, central Wisconsin. We wonder if your guest is aware of where one might get that, or if he knows of that apple, the golden russet.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I'll answer that question. Yeah, we have that apple in our collection, and... as individuals in our society, you can send an email and you know, let us know what you're interested in. In fact, if you use the internet, you can go do a Google on GRIN, GRIN. It means Germplasm Resources Information Network. It'll give you a list of all the apples we have in our collection. But one of the things I will caution is that we do a lot of research, and if we send anything out, it's usually a scion. Somebody has to learn how to graft it. What I do recommend is if it's commercially available, this is there are sources where you can find this. There's a book out published by some of our colleagues at the Seed Savers Association in Decorah, Iowa. They've got a book out called The Fruit, Berry, and Nut Inventory, 3rd Edition. So if you look that up on the internet, it'll give you a list of where you can purchase some of these apples. And I'm sure golden russet is one of those that can be found in a nursery someplace in maybe the Midwest.
Uh-huh.
So I think you would have luck finding golden russet.
We have a message from Mary from Minneapolis, who called to say that she just bought a farm with 60 apple trees and wants to know how one goes about identifying them. The book she's read have just told her that it's very hard to do.
Yeah, that's not an easy task because you can have an apple like Macintosh that looks entirely different in one locality than in another because it responds to the environment. If a Macintosh, I use that as an example, grows in the North Country like the Champlain Valley of New York State, it looks much different than one grown in the Hudson Valley because they enjoy the cool nights. So I don't feel that I'm an expert on identifying an apple. Just walking through as much experience as I've had with apples, I can give a guess, but I can never pin it down. But we do have a new technology out now where we're actually doing genetic fingerprinting of all the apples in our collection. So there will be a way to extract the DNA and pin that down at some point if somebody's willing to pay for that once a laboratory is set up where that could be done. But we're in the process of doing that right now, just doing a fingerprint for every apple in the collection.
It could very well be that Mary has some wonderful heirloom varieties in those among those apple trees, and that they could be recultivated. We have a wonderful antique heirloom apple grower here in Wisconsin who did that very thing with his grandfather's orchard. And he has some extraordinary and ancient varieties, including the King David apple, and a wonderful apple that's white-skinned or very, very pale-skinned and pink. The flesh is pink on the inside. It's a very beautiful apple.
Yeah, I have a feeling I know what that one that is. It's available commercially at some of these nurseries. It's one called Pink Pearl.
Pink Pearl,
it's
that's actually, right.
Yeah, it's got a yellowish, almost whitish flesh, but the pink color of the flesh actually kind of comes through the skin of the apple. You cut it open. In fact, this is one thing I wow people when we give a tour. We cut it open and see this beautiful pink flesh. But we also have some red-fleshed apples, some that are so red the flesh is almost purple. And there's a lot of interest in this right now in terms of the breeding community to develop a high-quality red-fleshed apple. I think within about 10 to 15 years, you may see something like this in the supermarket. So the novelty will be great to have that, but there may even be some health aspects. We have a saying among horticulturists that it's... if you eat your pigments, it's much healthier food. So if you have a red-fleshed apple, maybe a quarter of an apple a day will keep the doctor away instead of a full apple.
Mm. And we have another message from, I guess it's an anonymous message, which talks about, he says, my father, son of a North Rose, New York apple farmer, became a newspaper reporter. And when I was an early teen, Dad was invited to speak to the historian C. Harold King's class at the University of Miami. Afterward, Dr. King took my family to visit an old friend of his, the poet Robert Frost. As a teen, I wondered what my father and Mr. Frost would find in common. It was apples. They talked about apples in their from their childhoods, and Northern Spies came up frequently.
Mm-hmm.
Northern Spies, that's very old American apple, isn't it?
Yes, it's one of these, I guess you would call it the Johnny Appleseed gene pool, but it was found here in Farmington, New York, just 15 to 20 miles away from Geneva. So Northern Spy is kind of a standard for processing quality. It's got a beautiful yellow flesh, and if you want to make a good pie, use a spy, is what they say.
Uh-huh. We have Jim from Oconto joining us next. Hi, Jim. Thanks. Jim?
Questions. One of them is that I would like to know where to buy this apple tree called a greening, or it may be North American greening. And
yeah,
also, my apple trees get a like a fungus on the branches and on the trunk, and I'd like to know what to do about that.
Mm-hmm. The greening apple tree.
Well, there's a number of apples that have that greening name. There's one that has grown commercially in New York for processing. It's called Rhode Island Greening. But again, this publication called the Fruit, Berry, and Nut Inventory, third edition from the Seed Savers Association from Iowa, would have a list. So you can probably get on a website for the Seed Savers Association and get a copy of the book or find out where it can be found commercially. As far as fungus and diseases, I would check with your local cooperative extension. I'm not an expert in diagnosing diseases. I'm not a plant pathologist, but each of our cooperative extensions at our universities would be helpful in situations like this. University of Wisconsin-Madison, if you check with the extension office there, they might be able to help you with that.
Mm-hmm. Tim is next in Wausau. Hi, Tim.
Hi there. Yes, just wanted to share some good apple memories. One of my earliest memories is going to my great-aunt's house. They had a wealthy apple in their out in their yard, and she would make an apple spice cake, and I have the recipe, fortunately, and it's just absolutely wonderful. It brings back so many good memories.
Uh-huh.
It's just a typical farm wife recipe, nothing fancy, but it sure is wonderful.
And did you say it was a wealthy apple?
Yes.
That was the name of it?
Yes.
Now, that's
wealthy is a very good baking and eating apple.
Yeah, that's an old heirloom variety that's still grown in some districts. We have it here in some areas of New York. It's quite hardy. I think it grows in Wisconsin and Minnesota quite well.
Hmm. Well, speaking of recipes, I want to share this apple fennel soup recipe that I found in New York Times. No, it's called the it was a New York Times article that you mentioned earlier, Phil. The Curious yes. Cook Stalking the Placid yes. Apple's Untamed Kin. It makes sense to me, this recipe, combining apples Granny Smith, Winesap, Cameo, or Cortland, all those are tart apples and good for cooking, with fennel and a shallot and celery and chicken stock and white wine. Those things seem to go together to me. But then what's really interesting is that you add the juice of one lemon, 1 2/3 cups of heavy cream, 1 teaspoon Dijon mustard, and then 2 tablespoons of sturgeon caviar. Now, all of that together, that is mouthwatering. Interesting combinations of flavors there. Oh, and
it sounds like an adventure.
And yeah. Tarragon leaves too.
Mm.
We'll put this on our website for anybody who'd like to try it. And Dorothy joins us next from Quantico. Hi, Dorothy.
Hello.
Dorothy, go ahead.
I grew up in Upper Michigan, where my grandparents homesteaded in the early 1900s and planted apple trees that are still producing to this day.
Hmm. Do you know what kind they are?
I don't know officially what they are. There was a yellow variety that we called a summer apple, a red apple that ripened later we called a fall apple, and the third was a red apple we called winter apple, but it resembled Rome beauties that I see on the market today.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And so tell us about this apple orchard and how you think of it now. I'm thinking of the cherry orchard in Chekhov's play and what symbolic meaning it held for the family.
I'm very sentimental about it because my grandparents planted those trees.
Mm.
And I remember as a child climbing into the branches of the tree, eating apples and reading books.
Mm-hmm.
And deer coming into the apple orchard later in the fall to eat the fallen apples.
These must have been smooth-skinned trunks because a lot of apple trees are very spiky. It would be difficult to imagine hanging out in a spiky apple tree and reading a book.
Oh, I never thought of that. I suppose they were smooth-skinned.
Uh-huh.
I'll have to look the next time I go up there.
Okay.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of variability in terms of whether apples have almost thorny-type branches or smooth skin. In fact, I tell a story on this. Some of the apple species that we collected in China have, in their juvenile phase, very spiky spines. And I was out pruning these apples here 2 winters ago and with all my safety equipment on, but one of the thorns went right through the sole of my boot, so
Ooh.
I had to have that thorn removed.
Ooh, much like roses.
Yes, and it's... We always look at this as the tree is juvenile and trying to survive and actually produce fruit at some point. This is kind of a natural defense to keep the browsing animals away from the tree until it gets big enough to produce that fruit.
Uh-huh.
And then once they get into that, what they call a fruiting phase, they start losing a little bit of that thorniness.
We have a question from Patrick who wants to know why we have so few apple types in the United States, considering that there were once 10,000 of them. What happened to them all?
Okay, well, that's a good question. The growers have to be able to plant the apple tree and get a profit. So obviously they're going to plant something that they know they're going to get a profit from. That's probably, why some things go out of vogue, because, even though the apple may be good, it may not give the yield that they can make this profit for, but that's why it's good to have some of these heirloom varieties around that backyard gardeners and people that are doing roadside stands can still plant these. So there's certain areas here in upstate New York, we have a lot of that. In fact, You can go out and find a lot of different apples that you probably wouldn't find in a supermarket someplace down in Texas or someplace where you don't see a lot of apples. So it all depends on, the demand and where you are in terms of where you can find, the variety of apples.
And wasn't it true that many of those varieties were actually inedible and used primarily to make hard cider?
Yes, hard cider, there's a lot of interest in that right now. In fact, that seems to be the cider-type apples have a bit of a sweetness, but a little bit of astringency to them. So they're not edible out of the hand, but they add character to the hard cider. We actually have about 200 of these hard cider-type apples in our collection that have this trait. So we've got a lot of people that are interested now in developing hard cider industries or making their own hard cider.
Well, that's a good note to end on as we start the weekend. I want to thank you so much for being with us this hour, Phil Forslund.
Well, it was a pleasure.
You'll find a link to Phil Forslund's website and to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Apple Collection when you log on to hereonearth.org, where you'll also find free MP3s of our shows. If you'd like to purchase a CD of today's program, call the radio store 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 926K. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Brittany DeAnda was our engineer today. Lisa Boo is our webmaster, and Daniel Rosinski-Larson took your phone calls. The Big Apple Family was produced with the cooperation of the Division of International Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Jean Faraca.
Apple tree, still sitting under the apple tree with nobody else but me.
How many apples can you eat?